Young, it's here and now. In his first morning of Senate confirmation hearings for the post of Attorney General, White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez expressed disdain for Abu Ghraib-style torture. Gonzalez is facing intense questioning because of his 2002 memo to President Bush calling the Geneva Convention's restrictions on torturing prisoners obsolete. Critics say that led to abuses at the Abu Ghraib facility. Here's an exchange with Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont.
Do you approve of torture?
Absolutely not, Senator.
Do you condemn the interrogators, and you already answered this in part, at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, but again, for the record, do you condemn the interrogators' techniques at Abu Ghraib shown on the widely publicized photographs?
Let me say, Senator, that as a human being, I am sickened and outraged by those photos, but as someone who may be head of the department, I obviously don't want to provide any kind of legal opinion as to whether or not that conduct might be criminal.
Gonzalez also defended the detention of illegal aliens in this country following September 11th.
I do not support or favor the mistreatment, not only of aliens, but anyone by the Department of Justice. You have to recall that these actions taken by the department were shortly after 9/11. Everyone who was rounded up was either out of status with respect to their immigration status or had criminal charges pending against them.
Well, earlier today, we spoke with Henry Cisneros, President Clinton's Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. He wrote an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal expressing support for the Gonzalez nomination. We asked him why.
Well, it's my sense that this man is immensely qualified to be Attorney General of the United States. He has been an advisor to Governor Bush. He has been a member of the Texas Supreme Court. He has been Secretary of State of Texas. And for the last 4 years, has been involved in every legal question facing the administration as a member of the White House staff.
Well, you mentioned that he was involved in every legal question involved in the White House, and that's where most of the criticism was coming from. What's your response to the detractors who say that advice from Mr. Gonzalez led to the kind of abuse seen at Abu Ghraib, and this week accusations have surfaced about detainees at Guantanamo, and that he was telling his longtime boss, George Bush, what George Bush wanted to hear, and an attorney general needs to be a more independent thinker?
Well, I would say that he certainly set forth some legal positions in advising the White House in a time of war, which then were carried out, executed in a way that is not proper. But one has to separate the parameters that he set forth and then the manner in which they were executed by large organizations, our military organizations, in a time of stress, in a time of war. I don't think it is appropriate, it is seemly, to identify an individual as a scapegoat for a war that's at a very difficult stage. I'm a Democrat, and I supported John Kerry very strongly, but I don't think that it's appropriate to, with the American people having decided in November that they want to see this war through, that we would create a scapegoat out of one individual.
Well, some would, as you know, argue that what Mr. Gonzalez suggested or advised the president was as important as what ultimately happened. But putting that aside, most damning critics say that his thinking isn't rigorous. The Atlantic Monthly did an analysis of memos that Alberto Gonzalez sent to then-Governor George Bush for clemency considerations. And it was reported that the memos were filled with gruesome details of murders but little law. What about that criticism, that he really doesn't have the depth for the job?
I think it's unfounded criticism. The analyses that I have seen, including from many civil rights organizations, suggest that this is a person who is more open than many conservatives. His life experience prepares him for a better understanding of the plight of many American working people and people who are struggling.
He comes from a very poor background.
He comes from a very poor background and has shown a better understanding than I think we see in the present attorney general.
You just implied that his poor, impoverished origins are not only a virtue but a qualification for the job. Do you think, in fact, that he'll have a lighter touch, let's say, with Muslim minorities than the previous attorney general?
I can't say that specifically, but I do think that his life experience puts him in a position to understand a little bit about how the rougher side, those who are marginalized and those who are without rights and power, live in our society. Mm-hmm. He talks about his father as the hardest working person that he ever met, about living in a home that had no hot running water and no telephones, and his embarrassment. My hope is those memories will serve him well.
Well, Mr. Cisneros, you've said that you feel that Alberto Gonzalez is just being scapegoated for a war that isn't going well. But what do you say to average citizens without a political axe to grind who worry that the same man who seemed to dismiss human rights for detainees might do the same to U.S. citizens as Attorney General?
I think that the rulings that he may have articulated in a time of war are very different than his view of the law for Americans in general.
Well, Alberto Gonzalez's hearing today is also seen as a dress rehearsal for a possible Supreme Court appointment for Mr. Gonzalez. Yet this Supreme Court overturned some of his recommendations concerning the detainees.
Well, I don't see it that way. I'm not at all sure that he's Supreme Court material. That's another battle, another fight, another mm-hmm. nomination, another time, a hypothetical situation that doesn't exist today. What we're talking about is a qualification to be in the president's cabinet as attorney general. I believe he's qualified for that job. No one at this point is talking about a Supreme Court nomination. There's not even a seat open.
Henry Cisneros, how is the Latino community responding to the idea that there might be a Latino member of President Bush's cabinet?
The historic distinction of this nomination is that it's to one of the big four. Heretofore, the other six of us who've served as cabinet members have served in what might be called the outer circle departments, places like HUD and transportation and energy and education. Now we're talking about state, treasury, defense, and attorney general. And I think it's an immense point of pride for Latinos.
Henry Cisneros is a former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the Clinton administration. Mr. Cisneros, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Palestinians go to the polls this weekend to elect a new president. Who will be elected is already clear. Mahmoud Abbas, otherwise known as Abu Mazen, is leading in the polls with more than half the vote, while the closest runner-up lags far behind. But what exactly this election means is not clear. Joining us on the line from Jerusalem, our first, Molly Moore. Hi, Molly.
Hello. How are you?
Good. We also have John Ward Anderson, I think, sitting 4 feet from you. Hi, John.
Hi, Robin.
And you are co-bureau chiefs for the Washington Post in Jerusalem. Thanks so much for joining us. And in a few minutes, we're going to turn our attention to Israel. There are some new developments there as well. But let's talk first about these Palestinian elections coming up. And it's a great opportunity to remind us of some things. This is an election for only the second president of the Palestinian Authority, Yasser Arafat being the first. But who led the Palestinians previous to that?
Yes, you know, back during the British Mandate times, before Israel became an independent country, there was a Grand Mufti of Palestine, a religious and political leader who basically was the top authority here. And then when Israel became an independent state during the war in 1948, there were a lot of Palestinian refugees who were very widespread dispersed over the region. And subsequent to that, it was the creation of the Palestine Liberation Organization by the Arab League. And the PLO was then and remains today, the main voice and internationally recognized representative of the Palestinian people. It was in 1993, during negotiations with Israel, that the PLO agreed to establish the Palestinian Authority as the governing entity in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and they created the role of president, which Yasser Arafat assumed. And with his death, they were forced to go to elections to elect a new president for the Palestinian Authority.
Well, Molly, as we said, Mahmoud Abbas is expected to win the presidency. He's also known as Abu Mazen. A little bit about him, a more moderate leader, perhaps, than Yasser Arafat.
He's considered by many that he would probably be a more moderate leader. He has a long history of being involved in peace negotiations. He was, for a brief period of time, prime minister of the Palestinian Authority, a new position created 2 years ago during efforts to reform the Palestinian Authority at the behest of the United States and other foreign countries who wanted to see reform. Now, he's ended up being rather controversial. He is considered moderate by Israel and the United States. And in fact, a few days ago on the campaign trail, he called for Palestinian militants to stop firing the Qassam rockets and mortars into Israel. But at the same time, he's also campaigning, saying he would not raise arms against the militants or go against them. And in fact, in some of his campaign appearances, some of the most prominent militants on the West Bank have raised him on their shoulders and carried him through the streets.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that, because we are getting conflicting messages. As you said, he's called violence against Israelis stupid, but then also called Israel the Zionist enemy at a rally this week. John, is this just campaigning politics?
I think so. Look, this is what happens when you have elections. They've got to play to different constituencies. A recent poll, by the way, showed evenly split, 49% favoring the continuation of the armed intifada, 49% against it. And he's got to appeal to both sides.
Any sense that he can end the intifada, bring the militants under control?
The leaders that we've talked to from Fatah, the political organization that he represents, seem to think that they can control the militants, and specifically the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, which is the armed wing of Fatah. They believe they can bring under their control. Whether or not Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, whether or not he can actually stop Hamas and Islamic Jihad, I think is highly problematic. They're going to have some real tough negotiations between the various militant wings out there to try and bring them under control. And if they don't, you know, before the Palestinians had to go out and have a very brutal campaign to arrest a lot of the Hamas people. Mahmoud Abbas has said that he's not willing to do that, but in the final analysis, he may have to pull a rabbit out of his hat in order to get them to stop their military campaign against Israel.
And we want to talk more about Israel in a moment, but before we do, Molly, just want to ask you, with the elections coming up this weekend, what's happening? Are Palestinians excited? Is there a big turnout expected? Is there a sense in the air of something happening?
The Palestinians are very enthusiastic about these elections. I've spent the last few days in the Gaza Strip, and John's been on the West Bank. And people say even though Abu Mazen is perceived as the front runner and will likely win the elections, they're very enthusiastic about being able to go out and cast a ballot and have their opinion heard. And they point out that this is one of the first truly democratic elections in the entire Arab world. In Arab countries, you simply don't have different candidates like you do here running for election. So there's very much enthusiasm on the street.
And meanwhile, we should point out the militant groups, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, are sitting on the sidelines, which is an interesting note as well.
Well, that is their official position. However, in speaking to Hamas leaders, they're saying, we're not telling people not to vote. And many of the Hamas leaders I interviewed in Gaza said, in fact, they personally were going to vote.
That's Molly Moore. She and John Ward Anderson are co-bureau chiefs of the Washington Post based in Jerusalem. Both of you stay right there because we're going to take a break. When we return, we'll look at developments in Israel, where some settlers and Prime Minister Ariel Sharon are nearing a dangerous showdown over plans to close settlements. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Returning to our conversation with John Ward Anderson and Molly Moore. They are co-bureau chiefs for the Washington Post, based in Jerusalem, and incidentally husband and wife. And John, I want to start with you. The main news of the week in Israel has been these clashes between settlers and Israeli soldiers. In one incident, a settler drew a weapon on a soldier. How is this resonating? What's going on?
Well, it's created a lot of fear and loathing, actually. You know, in Israel, many times people talk in apocalyptic terms, and many of the political leaders are talking about how this is a threat to the state and a threat to the army. Well, what happened on Monday was that some IDF, Israeli army soldiers, went out to dismantle one of these small, tiny outposts. It's really just a couple of caravans on a hilltop. And when they got there, a man from a nearby settlement, who in fact was an Israeli soldier, donned his uniform snuck in under the guise that he was there to dismantle the outpost, and then sat down and started encouraging the soldiers to rebel and to not dismantle the outpost and to join him in saying that they weren't going to take down settlements. And it created quite a stir, because there's been a lot said over the past couple of months from rabbis associated with the military and some outside of the military, very, very influential ones, saying that perhaps the soldiers should not be involved in tearing down outposts. And so there's great concern that within the military there's going to be a division in some soldiers who will not follow orders and who will not take down these outposts.
Yeah, and Molly, we've heard of this before. We've had Israeli soldiers on our air who have objected to some, you know, government policies. But what's different about this? Is it the fact that they're confronting other Israelis?
Well, this is one of the issues, and I've gone to some of these outpost dismantlements in the past. And these soldiers are subject to all sorts of catcalls and
they've been called Nazis. Haven't they been called Nazis?
They've even been called Nazis to their face. They're being spit at by their own people. Now, the Army does not let them carry weapons in the past when they've done these dismantlings, so that the clashes don't become violent. And the soldiers are given very strict instructions before the clashes to not fight back with the settlers. But it puts the soldiers in a very difficult position. And as you mentioned, the soldiers here already are in a very difficult situation. As the Intifada continued on over the last 4 years, soldiers increasingly are questioning what they're doing as an occupation force in the West Bank, how they treat Palestinian civilians. And the Israeli military now, some people believe, is at a crisis point in trying to determine what it's going to become as an institution and what it's going to become to the Israeli public.
Is there a sense, too, John, as we have heard from one Israeli journalist, that these are soldiers who have given their lives protecting the settlers for so long, and now the settlers are, you know, calling them names?
Yes, very much so. And, you know, these cries of Nazi were ringing out just last Monday when they went up there to take down this outpost as well. And, in fact, there was a shot fired by an Israeli soldier, which, you know, sent a chill up the backs of the settlement community in Israel, which is very concerned that the Israeli government and Sharon are trying to turn the army against the settlement community here.
Yeah. Well, in the meantime, we just spoke at length about the Palestinians and mentioned that the new leader of the Palestinians will have the challenge of bringing the militants under control. Is there a sense across the borders of, you know, we'll take care of our militants / obstructionists if you take care of yours? Is there, are you feeling that?
It's not said so explicitly, but, you know, Sharon and the Israeli government have been on record for a long time, 2 years now, ever since the roadmap came into being, the U.S.-backed peace plan, that they've made a promise that they're going to take down these settlement outposts, and they have yet to fulfill that promise. And part of the reason is that you can see that it's a very, very highly charged emotional issue that could end up bringing the Jewish settlers into conflict with the army. But yes, there is a sense, I think, that Israel is going to, if it can make a stab at controlling the extremists on its side, that at a bare minimum, at the very barest minimum, they expect the Palestinians to rein in the extremists and the suicide bombers and the people who are launching Qassam rockets down in Gaza on their side.
Meanwhile, Ariel Sharon has announced that he has finally lined up a coalition government. Is that correct?
Yes, although, you know, it's not over until everybody has signed the papers and the Knesset has voted on it. But it seems that United Torah Judaism has agreed to join the Labor Party with Sharon to create a three-party coalition, which will give him about a three or a four-vote margin in the Knesset. He's been operating with only 40 votes. His own party, the Likud Party, has 40 seats in the Knesset, and that's all he's had now for about 2 months since his coalition collapsed, and the Knesset is 120 members. It now looks, though, that Labor and UTJ have agreed to support Sharon on his disengagement plan and vote with him to pull out of Gaza on the one hand, and also have agreed to vote with him on his budget, because Israel is still operating without a budget for next year, and that's another one of the key problems. There are a lot of people in the Knesset from left-wing parties who want to see more social spending, more more on education and less on the Intifada.
Well, Molly, from the Israeli side, how are they viewing this weekend's Palestinian election?
Well, they have been trying to keep relatively quiet on the elections until recently, when Abu Mazen came out with a statement mentioning the Zionist enemy. There was a hue and cry among Israeli leaders condemning him for that. Until that point, they had pretty much tried to keep out of the elections, because many Israeli leaders believed that if they came out and said anything supportive of any of the candidates, that that would, in fact, turn the Palestinians against that candidate. In fact, that is one issue you hear raised about Abu Mazen by some Palestinians, who say they believe that he would be too much in the pocket of Israel and the United States. On the other hand, other people say they're going to vote for him precisely because they think that he can bring Israel back to the negotiating table.
Well, we wait to see what happens this weekend. Thank you so much, both of you, for filling us in. Molly Moore and John Ward Anderson, co-bureau chiefs of the Washington Post Jerusalem Bureau. Thanks again.
You're very
welcome.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, as Iraqis prepare for their first democratic election in nearly 50 years, we'll check in on neighboring Iran and the role that country will play in Iraq's election. And The Syringa Tree, a stunning one-woman show about growing up white in a South Africa under apartheid. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. World leaders meeting in Jakarta today promised to work together to help identify the dead and aid survivors of this month's Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan urged nations to follow through with their pledges, which total $4 billion. Also, health officials are warning that the confirmed death toll of 140,000 could soon double because of disease. But there have been signs of hope. Nearly 7,000 of the dead from the tsunami lived on the remote Andaman and Nicobar Islands in the Indian Ocean, also home to 400 to 1,000 indigenous people in five ancient tribes. And today, members of the Jarawa tribe emerged from the forest to tell startled officials and an AP photographer that their people had survived, adding in broken Hindi, "Please don't take our picture. We fall sick if photographed." But one of the island's most reclusive tribes has not spoken, although they've been seen. This week, as they've done for centuries, members of the Sentinelese tribe shot arrows at outsiders, in this case a helicopter trying to reach them. The Indian government has declared it illegal to approach the tribe in an effort to protect them. Well, joining us on the line is Adam Goodhart. He's a scholar at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland, and an expert on the indigenous tribes of the Andaman and Nicobar Islands and the most reclusive, the Sentinelese. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you.
In fact, you've caught a glimpse of them?
Yeah, I visited the Andaman Islands in 1998. I was young and foolish then, and I decided I needed to catch a glimpse of these people, at least having come such a long way. So I made friends with some local fishermen who took me in their kind of dugout canoe across 30 miles of open ocean, and we managed to glimpse these people coming down to the beach, and I just saw dim little figures standing there naked on the sand, holding spears and bows and arrows and looking at us with great curiosity. It was sort of a marvelous moment, very, very moving, because I felt like it was one of the last places in the world where you can feel what it was like for some of the earliest Western explorers arriving in uncharted parts of the globe and glimpsing strange peoples for the first time.
Right. What a moment. And yes, you were well aware it was illegal.
Of course. And I certainly don't recommend that other people try to do what I did, not least of all because while I was out there, I barely escaped with my life because a monsoon storm blew up and swamped our little fishing boat.
And not to mention, but they would have shot you with a bow and arrow.
Yeah, we didn't have any intention of landing. But the history of these tribes and their interaction with the outside world, unfortunately, is very sad. 100 years ago, there were many more tribes in the Andaman Islands similar to these people who live on the island of North Sentinel. But then the British came in and other colonists, and they ended up being just devastated by Western diseases and Western civilization mm-hmm. as a whole, and they've almost vanished.
Well, these Sentinelese, how do these people know if they don't know anything about the outside world? How do they know they want to keep it out?
Well, that's hard to say, and it's interesting to try to imagine how the world looks to people from this island. They can see a few dim other islands on the horizon. They do see these strange machines, helicopters and planes and ships passing by fairly often that probably seem rather monstrous and scary to them.
Hence, reports of them shooting at helicopters with bows and arrows this week. And then later reports said they may have sensed the tsunami and escaped.
I was very relieved to hear these stories of the tribesmen coming out and shooting at the helicopter. And that says, of course, that some of them are alive. I also think it's too early to say that they're safe because all the reports coming in from the Andamans, and since it is such a remote area, the reports are still pretty sketchy, but there are indications that the ecosystems there have just been devastated and may suffer long-term effects. When I was off the island, I saw some of them coming out in a little canoe and fishing next to the reef, which is how they get much of their food. So if that stock of fish has been disrupted by the tsunami or the supplies of drinking water in many places in the islands, the groundwater has been contaminated by salt water now, it may have long-term effects that might push this already very fragile people and their culture over the edge. The people may actually believe that the tsunami was somehow caused by the outside world as an attack against them. They may fend outsiders off, even if those outsiders mm-hmm. come bearing help.
And as you say, you gazed at them, gazed into the past. What do we know about them? How do they get energy? How do they get heat?
We know very, very little about them because the only real contact that's happened in recent history, at least, between this tribe and the outside world was in 1991 when a group of Indian government officials managed to land on the beach after years of unsuccessful attempts, land on the beach and get the native people to sort of shyly take coconuts and other goods from them, and then the people ran back into the forest, and they've been left alone ever since. So there hasn't been much interaction. We do know some things about some of the tribes that appear very similar to them that live on nearby islands, and it's known that these people get fire, for the most part, from lightning strikes. They don't appear to have their own means of actually making fire.
They don't strike a flint. They don't strike stones together, use flint or?
Apparently not. It's also known that some of the tribes wear the bones of their dead ancestors around their necks as decoration, but other than that, they go almost completely naked. And they actually do use metal a little bit because they scavenge bits of metal from things that wash up on their beach and they make arrowheads out of that.
Mm. Outside of just the loss of a human being, what is the loss of a Sentinelese?
Well, I think it would also be a sort of a global loss in a larger sense because they represent, in a way, our last link to an important chapter of the human past. I think the age in which human beings first came into contact with uncontacted so-called peoples around the globe, in which they first had that moment of recognition of one another and stretching out their hands to recognize their common humanity across the gulf of separation that divided them. And this is the last place in the world, really, where that's still waiting to happen. I think also for somewhat more scientific reasons, it would be a terrible loss to lose these people and their knowledge, which represents millennia, perhaps even tens of millennia, of understanding of the world, of a way of looking at the world, of perhaps, as some people have suggested, an understanding of natural phenomena like the tsunami that may have allowed them to escape the initial wave. We still know almost nothing about these people, and they represent, in some ways, the last unspoiled link to the Stone Age past of our entire species.
Adam Goodhart is a scholar at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland, who's actually glimpsed the ancient Sentinelese people who are hopefully still alive on the islands off of India. Adam, one last thought. You know, we just envisioned some Hollywood producer landing in a balloon. Do you worry that the publicity about them is going to maybe do as much damage to them as, you know, the tsunami might have?
Well, that thought has occurred to me, but in fact, the last film crew to try to land and get footage on the island was about 30 years ago. A group from National Geographic went towards the beach, and there's some amazing footage that they got just before the film director was hit in the thigh with an arrow, and they beat a hasty retreat.
Right.
So given that kind of reception, I hope that the Sentinelese will be able to maintain the privacy that they obviously crave.
Adam Goodhart, thank you.
Thank you.
Adam is a scholar at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland. And still to come, we'll visit one Armenian community to find out what's on the table during the Feast of the Epiphany. That's today's Christian holiday. You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. And many of you have written asking how you can help with the various relief agencies we've spoken with in the wake of last week's tsunami. Well, that information is on our website, and we'll tell you how to get there in a moment. But first, Lynn Robinson of Philadelphia wrote after a report on the separatist movement in tsunami-ravaged Sumatra in Indonesia. She writes, "You said that the rebels are Muslim separatists. That label leads people to believe that the rebels are Muslim fundamentalists or terrorists, and the Indonesian government has simply been trying to control them. But Indonesia itself is a Muslim country, and the rebels in Aceh have rejected and expelled fundamentalists. In addition, the Indonesian army is one of the most brutal armies on the planet. The, quote, rebels in Aceh want to be free from abuse and want a better living standard. Calling them Muslim separatists can only lead the American public into being unmoved by their suffering." Well, after our interview with Nadia Labi of Legal Affairs magazine about cases of sexual abuse in the Amish community, Daniel Seipert of Charlotte, North Carolina, took issue because we asked if, like the Mormons confronting polygamy or the Catholics admitting sex abuse, the Amish would respond to outside pressure. Daniel wrote, "To say that consensual marriages performed over 100 years ago are similar to rape, incest, and child molestation today is insulting. A reminder, people who practice or have practiced polygamy since 1890 are not members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, nor are they endorsed by the Church." Dr. Harvey Finkel of Brookline, Massachusetts, phoned after Here and Now's health columnist Judy Foreman's report on concerns that the possible introduction of radiation screeners at airports would be unhealthy. Dr. Finkel had this to add.
"I would not think that we would trust the professionalism, the efficiency, and even the integrity of the people who, on behest of the government, would be running these machines. Ill-run radiation machines can be extremely dangerous. Even well-run radiation machines are potentially dangerous, but careful regulations by health professionals can keep that danger within bounds."
In our last letter segment, a listener wrote to say he didn't believe in the Immaculate Conception, meaning the birth of Christ. Well, many of you weighed in on what Mary DeRosier of New Hampshire called this theological nitpicking fray. Martin Krieger of Augusta, Michigan writes, "The term Immaculate Conception was used incorrectly. To some Catholics, it does not refer to the virgin birth of Jesus. It does refer to the belief that the Virgin Mary was conceived without original sin, thus making her an immaculate vessel to hold Jesus. It is celebrated as a holy day of obligation in early December." Candace McNulty of Prescott, Arizona, wrote with another correction after our piece on the Rose Bowl Parade. She writes, "As a child of Pasadena, California, I must defend the name of the Rose Parade. No bowl involved." Jason Williams of Cambridge, Massachusetts, phoned to say he loved our bittersweet story on the closing of Harvard Square's independent bookstore, Wordsworth.
"I met one of the most important people in my entire life while buying a book at Wordsworth. I still see her in that lovely moment like Juliet on her balcony, beckoning her gallant suitor. We quickly entered that timeless realm of the soul and heart, which has inspired so many authors of great poetry, song, memoir, and now a letter of thanks to you. A story told and well heard keeps the source of it alive in both of us.
Well, thank you, Jason. Susan Westcott of Thornton, Pennsylvania, put it another way. She says, "I love a man in a kilt." Susan was one of several who wrote after our piece on the radio documentary Tartan Spangled Banner, asking what was the music at the end. Well, Susan, it's Battlefield Band from the CD Leaving Friday Harbor. And as promised, for information on how you can help relief agencies in the wake of last week's tsunami, go to our website, here-now.org. And as always, we want to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message, 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. For only the second time since 1877, lawmakers in Congress are going to meet today to formally debate the results of the presidential election. Congress was scheduled to certify the November 2nd Electoral College tally, but this morning a small group of Democrats won the right to debate the results in both houses of Congress when California Senator Barbara Boxer signed on to a challenge raised by Michigan Congressman John Conyers, who claims, quote, intentional misconduct and illegal behavior by the Republican Secretary of State in Ohio. Well, joining us on the line from Washington, Richard Wolff, political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Hi, Richard.
Good to be with you.
John Harwood is here, too, national political correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. John, to you first. And first of all, is there any chance the November 2nd election will be overturned because of what's happening today?
There's about as much chance as that I'll be sworn in as president and you'll be my vice president.
Well, that could happen.
Which is to say zero.
Well, and that's what many are saying. But so, Richard, why is it happening?
Well, it's happening because there is this enduring bitterness about not just this election, but about 2000 among a significant part of the Democratic base. And there were obviously things that did not work well in Ohio that should and could have been handled better and in a less partisan way. But I think in large part this is the legacy of 2000.
But John, you weigh in. Aren't there legitimate questions lingering that seem to have been steamrolled and neglected? And isn't this an opportunity to at least raise them?
Well, there are legitimate questions about the way our elections are administered, not just in Ohio, but around the country. When you have unresolved issues over who can cast a provisional ballot and who can't, over which voting method is most accurate, over what sort of spoilage rate you have for paper ballots and glitches in computation by computers and that sort of thing. But there's not 118,000 votes worth of mistakes so far as anybody can tell, and it's no accident that John Kerry is out of the country while this is going on. He's somebody who may want to run again for president and doesn't want to be in the middle of this kind of a protest.
In fact, John Kerry, as you say, who's in the Middle East right now, has also not signed the challenge. But Richard, I'm wondering, maybe if there's not enough votes to overturn the election, are there enough votes and enough, as I think it's a Vermont electoral voter, says there's enough votes that show statistically there are too many in favor of the Republicans that have been unearthed that were in question. In other words, aren't there enough votes to question some part of the election, to have some format and forum to question it, if not overturn it?
There is a problem with the statistical analysis, which is that it's just that. It's not based on actual events or votes, whereas the counting of provisional ballots was a real event. And this isn't to minimize the problems. They were real. They were substantial. People were waiting for hours. Far too many people were waiting for far too long to vote in Ohio. And there were far too many challenges. There was also a very partisan Secretary of State. All of those things are very real problems, but the statistical analysis is the only way many of these advocates for overturning the results can make the case that there are enough votes, and it is just a mathematical analysis.
Yeah. John Harwood, what else do you think is going on here politically? I'm thinking of scenes from Fahrenheit 9/11, the Michael Moore documentary. After the 2000 election, minority legislators standing in Congress pleading for someone to sign on, as Barbara Boxer did today, to enable them to have this challenge. What else do you think is happening?
Well, I think you have an effort on the part of some Democrats like Barbara Boxer to stand up for on behalf of the party base, which doesn't like George Bush at all. That's an understatement, and wants to be heard on problems in election administration. And look, we do know that ballots aren't always counted accurately. Look at what happened in the recount in Washington State, where they went back and methodically went over hand by hand, and several hundred votes changed. And if this were an election where several hundred votes could make the difference, we'd be seeing a recount in Ohio, too. It's just that it isn't. But one, apart from the question of whether the election is overturned, which it won't be, you do have the potential salutary benefit of Barbara Boxer and Democrats who are contesting the vote calling attention to the need for more electoral administration reform. Country took some steps in this direction after 2000, but hasn't gone far enough.
Right. Well, at any rate, it is indeed a bitter tone at the very beginning, the first week of the 109th Congress. John Harwood, national political correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Richard Wolff, political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Thank you both for confabbing with us. Thank you.
Happy New Year, Robin.
Same to you. Today is the Feast of the Epiphany in many Christian churches, known by some as Little Christmas. It's the day that Christians believe that Christ was first presented to the three kings. In many Eastern churches, it's celebrated more extravagantly than December 25th, and it's marked by family gatherings, gift-giving, and food. Here now, Scott Haas went to explore the tastes and smells of the Epiphany at an Armenian grocery store in Watertown. It's home to one of the largest Armenian populations in Massachusetts, in fact, in the country, and he spoke with grocery store owner Hagop Buzmajian.
Show me some of the things that people need to have for an Armenian Christmas.
Right.
Okay, we're following down an aisle here, surrounded by an array of different spices that I think of as Middle Eastern spices, okay, because they're sumac, cumin.
Ground cumin, they use it in the nivik. The Iranian-Armenian, they use dill, leek, parsley, and coriander, cilantro. The Lebanese-Armenian, they use parsley and green onion, garlic, and mint.
And depending on where you're from, I mean, there's a nation of Armenia, but Armenians were spread out throughout the Ottoman Empire. You mentioned Syria, I think you said, and Lebanon, Iraq. So
Jordan,
depending on where you were brought up, that would influence the dish.
That's the dish they used.
And what do they do with these things?
They make the udja with it. It's they mix it with eggs and they make it like a little pancake, uh-huh, vegetable pancake. Another plate is the Swiss chard, green Swiss. They make nivik with it, pepper paste, tomato paste, Swiss chard and chickpeas.
When people make these kinds of dishes in their homes, is it something the whole family makes, or is it usually the mother or the grandmother?
The mother, grandmother, or some of the, you know, men of the family, they like to cook. The best chef in the world is men.
Well, not in the home. But have some of these traditions changed as a result of the Armenian community being in the United States for, what, at least in large numbers, about 80, 90 years?
They change. They're not like, you know, a lot of people, they forgot the little Christmas. They celebrate one Christmas, the American one, and they don't even go to the church.
So is it a big family dinner that people have, like the traditional Christmas? Or
it's a traditional. They all come together. They invite everybody. They come to the house and everything on the table.
Neighbors, everybody go.
You have to say your name before I...
Elizabeth.
You. And what do you do here, Elizabeth?
She's my wife.
Yeah, I miss the people, the neighbors. Everybody comes to your house, never stop. You have to give the cognac with chocolate or candy, whatever. It's a traditional.
And you dip the cookies in the cognac?
No.
You just drink the...
Well, they make special cognac with the sour cherry and arrack.
So in order to have the essential ingredients, the first dish are the pancakes you might have
with the Swiss chard. The Swiss chard. They call semsek.
Okay. And then a fish dish.
Baked fish or fried fish with rice on the side.
All right. And then finally the pastries and the fruits.
Pastries and the fruit.
And
that's the most important, yes.
And you've done it.
Yes.
was Hagop Bozmagian, pardon me, speaking with Here Now Scott Haas about how Armenians celebrate the Feast of the Epiphany and Happy Epiphany. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.